live in New Orleans have asked that I come and hold a crusade, and we're going to do a two-day crusade in New Orleans. Looking forward to doing this. We don't know what type of crowd we'll have, or, you know, so many people are gone. But it's something that the churches, especially the churches that are still there, that have remained open, this is something they want to do.
That's Reverend Franklin Graham talking about his New Orleans crusade next year. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's open lines for the next 25 minutes. I've got a question for you. We'll hear more from Franklin Graham in just a moment, but I want your answer to this question. If he starts his crusade by way of invitation to New Orleans, do you think that Franklin Graham will experience the same kind of success his father experienced in his long career of evangelistic crusades? Our calling numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines. I want your answer to that question, the Franklin Graham question. Now, if it's not Franklin, then who is the next Billy Graham? There's been all sorts of speculation. We talked recently with Greg Laurie. Some people say, well, Laurie's got the Harvest Crusades. He's the next Billy Graham. Others, I think it was Christianity Today at one time, speculated that perhaps it would be T.D. Jakes. And there are a lot of contenders out there for Billy Graham's legacy. Who do you think it would be? Who do you think it should be? Give us a call. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727 on one or both of those questions. Will Franklin Graham have the same success as his father in his crusade career? And if not Franklin, who is the next Billy Graham? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In about 20 minutes, Terry Mattingly joins us. He is author of the On Religion column for Scripps Howard News Service, and he's written a recent column on The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. We're going to be asking him about the film, get his reaction to it, and your reaction as well. This is your time to call with your various thoughts on The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe film. It's a pretty risky business, trying to take a much-beloved classic and turn it into a film, and we'll find out from you and from Terry how you think they did during Hour 3 of Issues Etc. No, that's in about 25 minutes here on Issues Etc. In the last half hour, another bit of open lines. We're going to play Name That Church Body. This is going to be very interesting. A Christmas greeting from a leader in a major church. We'll listen to it. I want you to tell me which church body it is. Just name the church body and why you think it is what you think it is. That's the last half hour. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's hear more from Franklin Graham. He says that much of New Orleans remains devastated even a month after Hurricane Katrina.
The human tragedy down there cannot be resolved easily. The loss of homes, the loss of jobs, people's dreams, their fortunes, everything they've ever worked to build up, you know, was just dashed in those few days. And that's why I think the pastors are so concerned that the city focus on God and ask for His help.
So the pastors in New Orleans want the city to come back around to a focus on God. And they're asking Franklin Graham, come down, let's have a crusade. We heard in that first audio clip that we played, we're not sure how many people will show up because it's still, in many ways, a very unpopulated area, but he's going down to conduct a crusade. Do you think that Franklin Graham is the heir to his father's crusade career? Do you think he'll have the same success as his father did? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I know everyone's got an opinion on this. And I know that everyone thinks that they might know who the next Billy Graham might be. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Here again, Franklin Graham says that New Orleans ministers simply asked him to lead this crusade on March 11th and 12th in 2006.
They sense they need God's help, and that's what we're wanting to draw attention to and try to get the country to focus on New Orleans and to pray for New Orleans.
Now, if you think about this as one of the things that was always a factor, I believe, in Billy Graham's long crusade career was television. And one of the things, I think Billy Graham would be the first to admit this, one of the things that made his crusade career what it was in the early days, the beginning of television, which covered him, and you could watch the crusade. I remember watching these as kids, and many of you remember watching it all the way back to when it was young Billy Graham on the stage in black and white. Well, you know that if Franklin Graham spends these 2 days down there in March of 2006 doing his crusade in New Orleans, it will also get similar coverage. Do you think he'll have the same success as his father? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And here's Franklin Graham. He says that the hurricane-ravaged city needs more than just a physical renewal and a physical revival.
New Orleans has been known for the Mardi Gras and Bourbon Street and these types of things, and there's so much more to New Orleans, but that's a part of the city that has had so much focus. And the churches are wanting New Orleans to come out with a new character. They're hoping that after the storm, there'll be a spiritual rebirth of New Orleans.
So a chance to start over again. I mean, now that even though Bourbon Street was relatively untouched, that whole district where much of the notoriety and the notorious behavior of New Orleans became famous, even though that was relatively untouched, here's a chance, some of these ministers in New Orleans think, for a second chance of New Orleans to come out with a different character and a way to do that. Franklin Graham and a crusade. Do you think it'll be a success? Not just this crusade, but a future career of Franklin Graham as a crusader like his father. I want to hear from you, your answer to that question, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Do you think that Franklin is the next Billy? Do you think it's T.D. Jakes? Do you think it's Greg Laurie? Is there someone else waiting in the wings to take Billy Graham's mantle when it is finally handed on? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You know, when we talked recently with Greg Laurie, I was really anxious to hear what he had to say. We saved it as our last question. You know, many people have said that Greg is going to be the next Billy Graham because he's already got everything in place. He's got his Harvest Crusades. He has a book career. He's a pretty famous pastor. And he seems ready to take up the mantle of Billy Graham. And I asked him the question, and he didn't give me a straight answer. He asked me first what I thought of Billy Graham and where I differed with Billy Graham, and he never really answered my question, whether he thought maybe that might be where he goes next. Do you think Franklin does it? Greg Laurie? T.D. Jakes? Somebody else? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In about 20 minutes here, Terry Mattingly joins us. I saw the film this weekend with our AM850 KFUO listeners on Saturday morning. I was pretty impressed with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I want to hear what your thoughts are on the film. Been reading a lot of reviews of it, some of them good, some of them not so good. But I want to hear from you in about 20 minutes as we talk with Terry Mattingly about the Chronicles of Narnia film. And then we'll play Name That Church Body in the last half hour of Issues, Etc. We've got a very, well, it's kind of a long Christmas greeting message, devotion, from a leader in a big church body. We're going to play it for you, not tell you who it is or where it comes from. We want you to tell us that. Name the church body and why. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You know what? You wonder if the career could be reproduced. I mean, you wonder, looking back on Billy Graham's career, whether it can be done again. Great success, worldwide success, television coverage. And while Franklin certainly sounds like his dad, it's almost uncanny how much he sounds like young Billy Graham, he makes statements that his dad, well, maybe might have made in his earlier days, but certainly wouldn't make today. Franklin Graham has talked about Islam as an evil religion. He has talked about Katrina as a possible judgment from God on a sinful city. And Billy certainly wouldn't be making those statements today, would he? I guess behind this question is, what was the key to Billy Graham's long and storied success? And can it be reproduced by his son or by someone else? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with Dennis, who calls from his car. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Pastor Todd. How are you today?
Very well.
You know, I don't know what impact Franklin Graham is going to have, because he's certainly coming up at a different time than his father did, with a different set of circumstances, politically and culturally. However, what I wanted to ask you is, what kind of impact do you think that Billy Graham had had on the culture of the United States, Western culture, and particularly the church culture at large?
That's a very good question. You know, people are going to be asking this, and we'll certainly be talking about it. At some point in the future, you know, Billy Graham is no spring chicken. In his 80s, his health is obviously failing, even though he's doing good for, you know, his conditions. But sooner or later, he is going to shuffle off this mortal coil as well, and people are going to be asking that very question, Dennis. What is Billy Graham's real legacy? You know, we've talked with guests, several, in fact, have pointed out that after 30-plus years of Billy Graham's worldwide crusades, there's not much to show for it. Just in terms of raw numbers, as a proportion to the general population, there's not that many more Christians than there were when he started. Now, your question is really more general than that, though. It is, what has been his impact on the church and on American culture? Well, on American culture, there will never be another one. I think that's safe to say. He has become the, in many ways, the preacher with an all-access pass to politicians, lawmakers, presidents, kings. Has that been positive entirely? You know, before a president decides to launch troops, he's likely to call Billy Graham. Say, Reverend Graham, what do you think? Here's what I'm thinking about doing. Take him into his confidence and ask his advice. What has Billy Graham advised? We don't know. On the church's culture... Well, let me say one more thing on the general culture. On the general culture, Billy Graham has become an icon for what a really good Christian in the public square ought to be. That's what people think. So Billy Graham kind of has set the standard. Non-confrontational, non-controversial. Shying away from making any kind of statements that might sound even an inch off of center. And therefore, not saying an awful lot of great substance, especially in his last years. I can think of one negative impact that Billy Graham has had on my church body. I don't know if he ever said it, although he is reported to have said that my church body, the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod, I don't know, even know when he was supposed to have said it, is a sleeping giant. The LCMS is a sleeping giant. And that has been a cause for more triumphalism, more of a theology of glory in my own circles than almost anything else. Whenever my church body's kind of feeling down on itself or wanting to, you know, come on, we don't do enough evangelism. We're a sleeping giant. Didn't Billy Graham say we were a sleeping giant? Well, I don't know if he did. I've yet to see anyone who can put it in print in front of me. But it has given us this view that we are somehow... destined for great things. Oh, yeah, we're only 2.5 million people, our church body, but wow. Billy Graham said we're a sleeping giant. And if we ever woke up, maybe we'd really be something. Giving us a false hope. Whereas what has always made my church body strong is its teaching, its theology. Not its potential for greatness or great accomplishments or even great size. Now, the greatest impact, I think, on the church in general is that Billy Graham has made completely mainstream decision theology. And to differ with him is, hey, I remember doing this in the first days of my time on this program, when we would say something... And criticize decision theology, that man must cooperate in some small way and have an act of his will, a commitment to give his life to Jesus, something like that, in order to be saved, people would say, you're disagreeing with Billy Graham. Almost as though I were contradicting Scripture. Billy Graham says, well, yeah, Billy Graham says, he has mainstreamed the teaching. So Franklin Graham's going to start his crusade, spring 2006, in New Orleans. Do you think he'll have the same success as his father? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And if it's not Billy's son, then who will it be to be the next Billy Graham? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Terry Mattingly will join us in about 15 minutes. We'll talk about The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Jerry calls from South County. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Todd. You know what? I think that Franklin Graham, I think he has the right insight on Islam, and I think it's time for truth rather than compromise and appeasement, which his father was just wonderful at. And I think Franklin, who sounds like his dad anyway, I think he's got the spirit and fire to replace his dad. I really think he can do it rather than this T.D. Jakes, are you kidding me, or Joel Olston or whatever these people are. I think Franklin would do just fine. And also, may I comment, Todd, the release of the C.S. Lewis movie?
Yeah.
I think it takes away from the children and interest in the birth of Jesus, baby Jesus, at this Christmas time. They should be concentrating on the true birth of the baby Jesus instead of the lions and the witches and the whole bit. I'm sorry. I cannot give a thumbs up for any of the C.S. Lewis nonsense.
Have you seen the film?
No, and I wouldn't even waste my time. I'd rather listen to Christian radio all day, 24/7, than waste my time on watching these things. I just think they're confused. The first impression a child gets is sticks. And when that child gets the first impression at the age of 3, 4, or 5 that God is a lion, it's going to stick. I think it's a very deceptive way to present Christianity.
Thank you very much, Jerry. Well, first of all, don't spend all your time listening to Christian radio. Please don't do that. I mean, after 6 o'clock, you can turn it off. 5:30 during December, you can turn it off. Is there a possibility that a 3-year-old seeing this film could get the impression that God is a lion? Maybe. If they have completely inept parents... Actually, I think it's probably more likely that the child would simply enjoy it as a story and not see any connection with the biblical message of Christ and the crucifixion. So I don't know that that's a problem. I mean, if we're going to toss out the analogies that are drawn, then we would also have to toss out the Lion of the Tribe of Judah or the Lamb of God and all of the other... what would you call it, analogies of animal husbandry or wildlife that are applied to God in Scripture. Now, with that said, there may be a small potential for that to be true, but I think far more likely is that this film could provide an opportunity for parents really talk to their kids about what Christ has done. You know, the danger of focusing on the baby Jesus is that you just keep... It's just baby picture time. I mean, how many of you have looked at your kids' baby pictures and think, oh, I just wish I could go back to those days. Life was simple and they were simple and it was just one ooh and on, one cute moment after another, and now life is so tough. And that's part of the danger of focusing on the baby Jesus, too. I mean, simply focusing on the baby Jesus. So danger lurks in both places. If the parents aren't willing to say, you know, the lion stands for someone else. The one thing that I think is good about The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, just to respond one more time to Jerry here, is that I would be really disappointed had Lewis written a book about the birth of a little lion cub. Rather, he talks about the death of this lion as a sacrifice for sin. And that's not the story. It is simply that is, as I told our listeners at our screening, Lewis is trying to tell the story in the language of fantasy and myth and talking animals. And I think he succeeds. It's Open Lines, Issues, Etc. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Tomorrow on Issues, Etc., We'll also be getting our holiday movie review with Brian Godawa. We'll also have Scott Klusendorf alongside to react to a series of ads, there are six of them, running in this area, running in Missouri, about stem cell research. If you've seen these, you know how slick these are. And you might have thought, hey, that sounds like something I want to support. Think again. We'll get Scott Klusendorf's reaction to each of these ads tomorrow on Issues Etc. Claire calls from High Ridge. Claire, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. In response to what the lady, the previous caller, made in, about the Chronicles of Narnia, I have not yet seen it, but of course I've read the book several times, and my younger son took his three children this past weekend to see the movie. They enjoyed the movie as a movie. He saw the Christian applications, and actually he came out with, he said people had been saying it was pertaining to the Christmas story, but he saw the resurrection in the story and liked the parallels that he saw in that. To be discussed at a later time, the children are five, and to be discussed at a later time with them, he felt that it was a valuable movie to see. And actually, he's not one who reads a lot, but it's interested him to go ahead and read C.S. Lewis now.
Thank you very much, Claire. So there's again, this is simply a door that is ajar that requires further pursuit, I believe. Keith calls from his car. Keith, welcome to Issues Etc.
Good afternoon, Pastor. How are you?
I'm doing well.
I just wanted to comment concerning Billy Graham. I have no idea who may be his eventual replacement, but given his decision theology, it may be best if no one replaces him. And
someone replaces him who can correct that theology.
Granted, I agree absolutely. Mm. I on as far as the popular evangelist, I don't know who that would be.
None I can think of. Did you have another thought, Keith, real quick?
I had a question, if I could.
Yeah.
Regarding the Missouri Synod, their doctrinal brief statement, I don't have it in front of me, but I believe it states that the doctrine of the synergist is apostasy from the Christian religion. Would you say that Billy Graham's decision theology is apostasy from the Christian religion?
Yes, that aspect of his theology, without a doubt. Now, what one hopes, what one sincerely hopes and prays, is that that clear error that man must work with God, cooperate with God by an action of his will or a movement of his emotions or something like that toward God in order to be saved, that is not consistently applied throughout one's entire theology, Billy Graham's entire theology. If it is, it will destroy the Christian message. Unwittingly destroy the Christian message. Now, if it is held inconsistently, where Billy Graham on his deathbed says, I trust Jesus, not the decision I made for Jesus, well, then that's inconsistently held, and then it does not do the damage that we talked about. But yes, that error, if allowed to run its course through one's theology, is apostasy. There's no two ways about it. And it's not a slight danger. False doctrine is always dangerous. We'll be right back.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The story of Jesus' incarnation, the story of Jesus' birth, the story of Christmas is a story for Christians of all ages. Our Savior took the path of the Virgin's womb to the cross for us sinners. It all begins in Bethlehem. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for December is called The Shepherd's Christmas Story, and it tells the story of Christ's birth in Bethlehem. This book is $12.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, you can visit our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find The Shepherd's Christmas Story right there on the homepage. Or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues Etc. book of the month for December, The Shepherd's Christmas Story.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Virginia Senator George Allen will not vote for any hate crimes legislation that includes gays and lesbians as a special class of protected citizens. His decision is in part based on the experience of 11 Christians who were arrested for preaching the gospel at a gay rally in Philadelphia. Steve Jordahl reports.
Allen says activist courts will use the legislation as a stepping stone to a new class of federally recognized civil rights. He's also concerned that the right of Christians to speak truth in the public square is being compromised. Spokesman Michael Thomas.
He is concerned that this could have a chilling effect on First Amendment rights of free speech.
Amanda Banks, a Focus on the Family Action, says Allen's courage could be an inspiration to his colleagues.
It's very likely that he will have an effect on other senators who will be faced with this vote again in 2006, and it's not going to be an easy one.
Senator Allen specifically referred to the arrests in Philadelphia as evidence of the need to protect Christian speech. Michael Markavich of Repent America was one of those arrested.
We were singing Blessed Be the Name of the Lord in the public streets while we were surrounded by this group of homosexuals. And the police decided not to arrest the homosexuals, but to arrest the Christians. And that's exactly what hate crimes legislation will do. It will criminalize Christians for simply speaking the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Jeff Montgomery of the Triangle Foundation reveals the underlying motive behind his organization's backing of gay-friendly legislation.
This is all about normalizing every single American, whether they happen to be gay or not.
Read that, normalizing homosexuality. And once it's enshrined in federal law, it will be impossible to keep out of schools, workplaces, and even pulpits. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
Thomas says a bill granting hate crimes protection to gays could come before the Senate in a matter of weeks. Senator Allen voted for the bill in the past. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
When St. Paul said, "We preach Christ and Him crucified," did he mean that the entire substance of Christian preaching ought to be the forgiveness of sins in the perfect life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. I've written an article for the Next Issues Etc. Journal on listening to a sermon. We'll send you a free complimentary copy. Just call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. This article will give you a simple test to see if your pastor is preaching Christ crucified. 1-800-737-0172. Dr. Rod Rosenblatt of the White Horse Inn has an article on the false Christ being preached in our day, and the Wittenberg Trail feature details how an Eastern Orthodox priest became a Lutheran pastor. 1-800-737-0172. If you enjoy Issues Etc., the radio program, you need to get the Issues Etc. Journal, 1-800-737-0172.
I think the book was great and the movie was even better.
I thought it was awesome.
I liked it.
I think it's cool that it's based on the Bible.
C.S. Lewis would have loved it.
It was probably one of the best movies I've ever seen. The battle scenes were great, far beyond Lord of the Rings.
Now I can see we will win in the long run. Christ is our Savior.
That's some of the reaction outside the movie theater at the opening of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe this weekend. We're going to be talking about the film. I want your reaction to it as well. Terry Mattingly joins us. He's Senior Fellow for Journalism at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He's author of the On Religion column for Scripps Howard News Service, and he's written a recent column titled The Lion, the Witch, and the Fans. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to talk to you.
Well, I was intrigued by one of the comments made by the moviegoer there where they said Lewis would have loved it. What do you think Lewis would have thought of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe?
Well, this was a guy that kind of thought newspapers were a bit too trendy and high-tech. So I can honestly say that I don't have any idea what he would think of this. You know, his stepson, Doug Gresham, is convinced that Lewis liked anything that involved excitement and archetypal images and that he would have liked it. And, of course, Gresham said that he set out to make a film that he thought Lewis would like or appreciate. So, you know, we can't read the man's mind. We can only say that he did have a lot of problems with certain aspects of modernity, and he certainly would have been critical of certain things. I think that he might have been pretty critical of some of the wisecracking between the children.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, the whole casual attitude with which modern children handle each other and kind of are snide and throw things back and forth at each other, Lewis's children do that a little bit in Narnia. I mean, you can think of some of the wisecracks between Diggory and Polly in The Magician's Nephew, for example, but not to the degree that they're, you know, in this film. So the young people do talk a little bit modern, and I think, you know, that might have irked him.
It is very risky business, both of those terms being pertinent. Very risky business trying to take a much beloved and very well-known classic of modern literature and put it onto film, isn't it, Terry?
Well, yeah, and it's also risky to write things that aren't in the book. I mean, you know, there are some of us who know the book so well that the minute something happens that isn't in the book, you just flinch. And sometimes it takes a couple of minutes for your mind to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the action sequences that have been inserted into the plot, I mean, you know, you just sit there going, you know, why are we having to watch this for 5 or 6 minutes when he could have given us more of the dialogue? Except the modern moviegoer wants action set pieces. They expect it, right?
So, generally speaking, and of course, feel free to get specific with some criticism too. How do you think the book survived in the film?
Well, I gave it a solid B+, just kind of in my own mind, especially after I saw it again. And the second time I saw it, some of the added sections didn't bother me as much because I knew they were coming. So I think the religious message of the film certainly survived. And in a couple of cases, there were even lines that may have strengthened it or more clearly defined it. So, I don't think that Christian fans of the book really have much ground to stand on. I can honestly say that the only part of the movie that severely disappointed me was the music. And some of the music is lovely. I've been listening to the soundtrack a little bit today, and some of it's really pretty, but there just are not the huge, massive statements of gorgeous theme that you need to make this movie stick in your brain and not go away. Nothing like the Lord of the Rings soundtrack, certainly. Let's face it, this witch deserved a Darth Vader theme or something, didn't she?
Yeah. That's what struck me as well, was the music. It distracted me a little bit, Terry. I was watching it with my daughter, and I was thinking to myself, I wasn't so much thinking what kind of music I should be hearing, but I was thinking, this sounds... It, very voicey kind of music, lots of voices in the music. This sounds too ethereal for a world that in Lewis's mind was supposed to be as real as this one, but another world. And this sounds a little New Agey.
I think they were going for the sound. In that case, they went for kind of a low-rent Enya. And that kind of sounded a little bit like the very first of the Lord of the Rings soundtracks, especially the female sort of vague voiceover stuff during the opening credits sequence. That sounded very Enya, didn't it?
Yeah, my producer leaned over to me in the first few minutes of the movie. We were watching it together, and he said they must have gotten Yanni to do some of this stuff because it had that same kind of world music feel to it.
A little bit, yeah. At the same time, I thought... the musical cue during the Narnian lullaby section,
yes,
with the fire, I thought that was a devastatingly effective cue. In fact, I said, you know, why did that have to only last for a minute and 30 seconds while some of the other stuff went on forever? I wanted them to pull the pipes and the dancing drums back out. That would have been very, very effective.
Folks, I want to hear from you. What did you think about the movie The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? Our call-in numbers, 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. We have Terry Mattingly with us and getting his thoughts on it as well. Let's talk with Jenna, who calls from Wisconsin. She listens on the Internet. Jenna, welcome.
Hi, Todd. Great show.
Thank you.
As always, Merry Christmas. I was calling to respond to your caller a few minutes ago. I think her name was Jerry. I just couldn't disagree with her more. She seemed to have a great disdain for the book in the movie. I took my kids over the weekend, and we were enthralled. I mean, there's just no other word for it. You get sucked into the movie, just the cinematography of it, but the story has stuck with us, and we're very familiar with it from reading it. But it's not the type of story that distracts you from the message of Christmas. I think it's a wonderful opportunity to implement. And Jesus was the master storyteller with his parables. And I don't quite understand the disdain towards using stories as a teaching tool for our children, especially at Christmas time. I think this is a wonderful story that opens the door for us to talk about the story of Christmas with our children.
Jenna, thank you very much for the call. Terry, not to leave you at a disadvantage, we had a caller before we brought you on the air who said, in essence, that she thought that depicting a Christ figure like a lion is a distraction for children at this time of the year when they should be focusing on the birth of Jesus Christ. Your reaction?
Well, there are some people, and pardon me if I make the statement that in some of the more literal forms of Protestantism, there are some people that just have a lot of trouble with religious art in general. You know, whether it's visual art, whether it's story art, let alone whether it's movies or something like that. So I think there are some people that just don't want to see religious material in artistic form. They want their doctrine straight in that sense, or they want Bible stories.
Now, let's talk about some of those sections that you thought didn't work and some of the sections that you thought strengthened the film, in particular where events might have been shifted around, conflated, or even added in. What about the ones that didn't work?
Well, the poster child, you know, for me, for that image, is the entire frozen river battling the wolves ice flow section. You're sitting there. I mean, to some degree, I guess, yes, you can imply that the river had to thaw, and you could imply that they had to cross the river, but I think that that whole sequence was just in the movie for, you know, for visual excitement and more digital effects. And then one moment in particular that bugged me, when they come out of the riverbank and supposedly Peter has literally lost Lucy, and he's holding her coat, and they think Lucy's dead. I mean, instead of just screaming in grief, the wisecracking Susan hits Peter with, "Well, what have you done now?" That didn't exactly ring emotionally true to me at the moment.
You know, I thought when they came out of the river and they were all back on the bank safely, I thought to myself, how did that move the story along in any way, and knowing it was an addition? What did that add to the story?
Yeah, that sequence kind of just bothered me on a host of levels. And the second time when I saw the film, I guess knowing it was coming, it didn't bother me as bad.
Now, what about the battle scene? Because Lewis, I think, describes the battle very sketchily.
Yeah.
He does it in, I think, a page and a half. And this film made the battle a major piece for the latter part of the third act.
Right.
What did you think about it?
Welcome to New Zealand and the post-Lord of the Rings world. I will say this. I have to admit that I liked the battle sequence quite a bit. I thought it went on perhaps a little bit long, but I liked it a lot, if only for the fact that, as a bit of a technology geek, this is one of the first times you have seen massive CG mythical creature, battle charge, warfare, kind of Lord of the Rings meets Braveheart, whatever, done in broad daylight. Did you notice that?
Yeah, I noticed that too.
Now, in Star Wars, you're against black sky, you're against deep space. Most of the battle scenes in Lord of the Rings are shot at night, or they're shot against the gray cloud of the cover of evil, which helps you hide, you know, and mask all the lines between CG and real. Boy, this was totally unforgiving, wasn't it? I mean, broad daylight. And you watch that shot of the armies running toward each other, and the CG animals even have shadows, you know, rippling in the grass on the ground. It's got to be some of the most detailed stuff that anybody has pulled off. And as always, the guys at Weta, you know, Richard Taylor and the guys at that amazing shop down in New Zealand, deserve astonishing credit for that. But the battle sequence, you had to do it. You had to let the modern audience see what that looked like.
Now, a couple other things on, since you mentioned CG animals, Aslan, I mean, if anybody in this film has got to be a believable character,
mm-hmm,
visually, it's got to be Aslan. It cannot look, you know, in the least bit put together. How do you assess the fact that, you know, you're looking at this, we all are able to suspend disbelief, But we're looking at this, and you say, I know it's not a real lion, because real lions don't talk, and that's bigger than a real lion, and things like that. How do you think Aslan came across?
Yeah, this was Aslan, the first draft. And frankly, I thought it was a lot better than some of the stuff we saw in the early trailers. A friend of mine said he saw the first trailer, you know, and, you know, this is a guy that loves the books. You know, and he couldn't help it. You know, Aslan turns and faces in the camera, and the first thing he thinks is Mr. Ed. Well, it was not that bad at all. They did a lot. In fact, I thought some of the facial expressions on Aslan were amazing. There's some subtle stuff going on right after Aslan comes out of the pavilion from his talk with the witch. There's some amazing stuff going on between Lucy and Aslan's face. And I thought to myself, well, if they get it down that well in the first draft and then improve it in the subsequent films, this is going to turn out okay. You know, the one theological point I'd like to make?
Sure.
Aslan should have been larger after the stone table than he was before. And they didn't physically change his size. And the book is very specific about that. That after the stone table, he looks larger to them even. I thought that would have been an interesting point if they had literally made him bigger.
What about the death and resurrection scene?
The only thing that bothered me about it really was the fact that there was no blood whatsoever. Did that strike you as strange?
I've heard people mention this.
It's kind of hard to stab a lion through the heart and not produce a single drop of blood.
No pool of blood beneath his body, nothing like that.
Yeah. I thought it was okay. You know, once again, I was a little bit disappointed in that, but not really.
And the resurrection, this was the moment I was thinking, you know, here's where the whole film could not fall apart, but here's where the whole film could kind of go off track or something.
Yeah.
What I was concerned about is my daughter had read the book up to the death of Aslan. She had not read to the point of the resurrection. She just ran out of time. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't want this film to leave the impression in any way that Aslan wasn't really truly dead and this isn't really a resurrection. Maybe he swooned, something along those lines.
Yeah.
What do you think, Terry?
Well, it would have helped if they had it be a slightly more literal bloody death in that sense. But I don't think there's any question he's dead. And then they have him, you know, they have at least a little bit of the are you real, are you alive now dialogue. That's one of the places where they added a line. The line where he talks about if she had really understood the true meaning of sacrifice. And you know, adding sacrifice as a line, I thought was interesting and crucial. That was the moment that more people were worried about than any other in terms of the dialogue, and they got that speech basically right.
Anything else you think that was added in the film, you know, comparing it to the book, that genuinely strengthened the entire message, the entire story?
Oh yeah, Edmund. I think we have a much better understanding of who Edmund is and why he does what he does. I thought the character of Mr. Tumnus was given a little bit more screen time, and I thought that was delightful. I love the handshaking scene. I mean, that's going to end. It's kind of a classic little touch of the director. I thought the biggest change to me in terms of addition was the chance to see why Edmund was mad, and then also to clearly see his guilt in the Ice Palace scene with Tumnus and stuff. All of that was new material, but I thought it thoroughly fit the character, and there had to be a time when he knew what he had done. And that devastating line from the witch where she says that he sold out his family for sweeties.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, that's, you know, just, man, does that hit. And she delivers it so fake, sweet, calmly. It's just ice. And the cutback to Edmund at that point is very effective, and he does know what he's done.
Folks,
you know, and I thought that was effective.
Folks, what did you think about the movie The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? We've got a few minutes left here with Terry Mattingly. Time for you to call 505-7850, 1-800-730. 2727. And then in the next hour, coming up in just about 5 or 6 minutes, we're going to play Name That Church Body. Terry, the White Witch, as far as she appeared on screen, this was the character that I thought had to come. You mentioned she needed a Darth Vader theme.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought she had to come across as, you know, evil incarnate in order for the story to really work the way it ought to work. Do you think they succeeded?
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, they got a brilliant actress. She's like 5'11". I guess the only actress you could have gotten that would have been taller for the role would have been Sigourney Weaver or something like that. But I thought she was tremendous. And I liked the fact that she didn't shout much. I thought she was scarier for the ability to kind of be quiet, then lunge. You know, I hope she gets nominated for Best Supporting Actress for the role.
And
I think that's one of the only Oscar chances they've got, you know, in this great year of the gay film, you know, as some people are beginning to call it.
Philip calls from his car. Philip, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi.
Hi, Philip.
Hey, I just thought, with the movie, I thought that the scene with Aslan being killed, that was just really powerful for me, just because, like, when you see the movie The Passion, you see Jesus dying, and you know he's all-powerful, but seeing a massive lion like that being killed, when you can see he can fight back, that was just really powerful for me with the movie.
Thank you, Philip. Your thoughts, Terry?
Well, yeah, and of course, as someone who read the books a long, long time ago, none of that could surprise me. It was very interesting to me to sit in a theater and actually realize that there were people around me who didn't know what was going to happen. And that, you know, I guess you intellectually know that's the case, but it's still kind of funny to sit there and realize, you know, and hear it. So, you know, I can honestly say that parts of the movie did have a lot of effect on the audience, you know, around me. And you got to say it was effective to some degree.
What about, you know, this is as much a story, the way the film has put it together, about the youngest child, Lucy.
Yeah.
It's kind of bookended with Lucy and Peter. Peter kind of gets the next sequence there in the film. But the actress who played her, I cannot believe the casting that they did with these kids, but especially her character at her age to play the whole gamut of emotions she does, but also to play it genuinely the way that character had to come across as childlike faith.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very hard to know what the members of the Academy can do with child performances. I think it would be very interesting to see if she was considered a supporting role. But if you stop and think about it, she's got to have more screen time than anybody else. So I don't think you're going to be able to consider her for supporting actress. She pretty much is the lead of the film, isn't she?
Yes.
Yeah. I thought she was wonderful. And Lucy is the most beloved character of the early Narnia books. And I thought she was wonderful.
A couple other questions here. There was a shift in kind of the sequence of things a little bit toward the middle of the film that I thought they worked out pretty well. But then they brought out a character that is very minor in the book, the fox, and made him a key in a plot turn. What did you think about that?
It didn't really bother me. I thought he was the fakest looking CG. I was reading somewhere yesterday that it said things were going along pretty long. We're in Lord of the Rings, and then some fox from Disney walks in. And, you know, and you've got people that, you know, are miffed a bit because the fox is voiced by an extremely well-known gay actor, you know, and so some people are a little bit upset about that. But it didn't bother me. That's the whole action sequence, gotta make you excited section of the movie, where they changed the most. And they left the key parts of the plot intact. You got to let them do something with the movie.
And then Aslan's voice. This is, I've read more people commenting on Liam Neeson's voicing of Aslan than anything else. What is your thought on that?
I thought he was fine. I must admit I had an actor I would have preferred. And actually, I have some friends involved in the making of the movie, and I kind of nominated this guy behind the scenes. I don't know whether they ever seriously considered him. I thought Liam Neeson was fine. The person I had wanted for the role was John Rhys Davies.
How would we know him, Terry?
You would know him as from Lord of the Rings as the dwarf Gimli.
Wow.
And he also, of course, did Treebeard, and he has this voice. He has kind of a Shakespearean-trained voice that both has the ability to really roar and also be light and whimsical and funny at the same time. But I thought I had no qualms about that.
Now, the plan is, of course, CG movies take forever to make, but the plan is to do all seven books.
Correct.
Do you think it'll work? Do you think it can...
We're not going to know for another week or two. I know they must be counting on massive DVD sales, and I'm sure they will get it. The movie did better in foreign markets opening weekend than they could have dreamed. You stop and think about it. This was the biggest opening weekend in the history of Disney. You know, that says something right there. But it's got to stay strong through about 2 weeks and get to $200 million pretty fast. You know, or I think they would do a little bit of rethinking of the next film, or you know how much funding the next film gets, or whatever.
Terry, real quickly, with less than 30 seconds, I understand you have a new book out. Tell us about it.
Yes, I do. It's called Pop Goes Religion: Faith in Popular Culture, and all the stuff that you and I have been talking about. A lot of it, to one degree or another, is in the book. Only about a host of different subjects, from Harry Potter to U2 to The Matrix to Star Wars to Johnny Cash to all kinds of popular culture that deals with religion but takes on issues of faith in story form and music and whatever. So I would recommend it to your listeners and appreciate anything they can do to help it.
Well, Terry, we'll have you back on to talk about that book. Thanks for being our guest.
Thank you.
tmatt.net, tmatt.net is the website for our guest, Terry Mattingly. You can visit him there. He has written a column titled The Lion, the Witch, and the Fans. He's author of the On Religion column for Scripps Howard News Service, and he's senior fellow for journalism and the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. When we come back from this break, name that church body. We've got a Christmas address, Christmas devotion, from a leader in a major church body. We're going to play it for you, stop and start, give you a chance momentarily throughout its 10 minutes to guess which church body it is. You name that church body, be ready to tell us why after this break. Open lines, issues, etc. for the last 25 minutes. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.